The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And by Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
Hello, hello. I'm Taylor Quimby.
I'm Jackie Helbert.
And this is Word of Mouth, your questions answered,
your state explored.
So today on the show, we've got a special presentation, a new NHPR podcast that is, depending on how you're counting, either 2 years in the making or 30 years in the making. It's a true crime story told over six, sort of seven episodes called Bear Brook.
And we're in the studio with the host, Jason Moon. Jason, what's your actual job title in HPR?
What is my job title? Reporter is safe to say. I'm a reporter in the newsroom here.
What's your beat usually?
Well, before the podcast, I covered education and the seacoast of New Hampshire, such as it is, 13 miles of it. After the podcast, I'll be covering health.
Okay, so I am going to wait to ask you how you went from education to murder. we'll talk about that after we listen to the first episode. We're going to do that now in its entirety. Jason's going to stick around, tell us afterwards how the project came to be, what to expect later in the series, and how true crime reporting compares to covering, say, education.
And before we hit play, listeners should know that there is some graphic details in the podcast.
Yeah, it is true crime.
You know those 80s movies where a bunch of kids wander the neighborhood on bicycles and then stumble into a mystery? This story starts kind of like that.
You know, growing up, there was probably, you know, a good two or three dozen kids that lived in the park, and we just roamed the place like we owned the place.
That's Jesse Morgan. In the movie version of this story, he'd probably be the leader of the group, the scrappy one, the Corey Feldman.
The way the trailer parks work, I mean, there's a lot of people that come in and go out. I mean, I was one of the few kids that moved in when I was two and moved out when I was 18.
In the summer of 1985, Jesse was 11 years old. It was the year the Nintendo came to North America. New Coke hit the shelves, and Calvin and Hobbes started running in newspapers. That year, Jesse and his friends came up with a game. It was basically hide and seek, except the seeker rode around on a four-wheeler.
All the kids would hide, and the last one that got found would be able to ride the four-wheeler, just do that over and over. And we played all summer long.
The trailer park where Jesse grew up, it's in a town so small that half of its main street is technically in another village. And right next to the trailer park, covering more than half of the entire town, is 15 square miles of tall red pines and swampy, tangled forest. Bear Brook State Park.
We were able to roam because we weren't in a city. You know, my parents weren't worried so much about me because they just figured I was over there. You know, there was only so many places to go when we were kids.
And one day, in the middle of this game, something strange happened. Jesse was riding the four-wheeler. His friends, Scott and Keith, were supposed to be hiding. And then one of them gave himself away by yelling out.
I believe it was Keith that said that he found a barrel just out in the woods. You know, there was a barrel out there.
The barrel was a blue 55-gallon steel drum. It was covered up with a lid, but whoever closed it hadn't gotten a tight seal. Something was squeezing through underneath the top. It was a plastic bag.
Scott and Keith both got off the four-wheeler, and Keith was, like, trying to pull the top of the barrel off. And when he got the edge of the tarp off, we got hit with, like, this smell of, like, rotten milk.
The kids weren't really sure what to make of this, so they did the only thing a group of 11-year-old boys could think to do. They kicked it over.
When we knocked the barrel over, the top came open a little more, but we didn't see into it or anything. we saw like something white was starting to drizzle out of the top of the barrel. And again, I'm thinking it's rotten milk.
And then they left. They rode away on the four-wheeler without ever looking inside the barrel.
That was it. So that was, we left.
This is the moment where the story stops being like an 80s movie. Jesse and his friends walked away from the mystery. Had they looked inside the barrel, what they would have found were two bodies. Heavily decomposed, partially dismembered. This moment in the woods is the first in a case where every convention about how true crime stories usually unfold is upended. Where everything about how a murder investigation is supposed to work happens in reverse. Where each break in the case seems to raise more questions than it answers. It's the first clue that this story is not going to go the way you think it is.
How does an entire family just go missing?
This is the story of a serial killer police would come to know as the Chameleon.
I'm sure she fought. I have to believe that she fought.
The story of victims, some of them well-remembered, some of them nameless.
What grandmother let this happen? Or what neighbor or what bus driver? Or, you know, I mean, where were all of you? You know, I mean, I where were you, you know?
And it's the story of a frustrating investigation that after decades of failure led to a forensic breakthrough that has forever changed the science of solving murders.
I mean, this is the biggest step forward for solving crime since the discovery of DNA itself.
This is Bear Brook. I'm Jason Moon. I am not a crime reporter, or I wasn't until I discovered this story. I first learned about the Bear Brook murders in late 2015 when I was assigned to cover a press conference about the case. I'd only been living in New Hampshire for about 6 months. I didn't know anything about the case. At the time, I was more concerned with covering the New Hampshire presidential primary. The week before, I was being crushed by a throng of other reporters while trying to follow Hillary Clinton down a hallway. Aside from the primary, New Hampshire is pretty quiet. There isn't the same urgency to news that there is in some other places. It's the sort of state where a rogue bear can and has dominated a news cycle. So when I learned that in 1985, bodies were discovered only 20 minutes or so from the NHPR newsroom, and that police still hadn't identified them 30 years later, it stuck with me. How is that possible? With all of the DNA testing and modern forensic techniques, how could they not even know who the victims are? After that news conference, I filed a short story for the newsroom and went back to my usual beat. But I never forgot about the Bear Brook case. It became a kind of side project, something to look into when I wasn't sitting at a town hall meeting or covering the state legislature. And one of the first things I wanted to learn more about was the town where the bodies were found. The town where Jesse Morgan, who found the barrel as a kid, grew up. A town with a population just shy of 4,300.
You got it?
Sounds good.
All right.
Allenstown, New Hampshire.
We were only going to be there a few years. It wasn't. Yeah. And then he started the business and the, you know, life went on and before you know it.
Jesse's parents, Ann and Kevin Morgan, moved to Allenstown in the 1970s into a trailer park called Bear Brook Gardens. The Morgans have been married a long time. They're not exactly finishing each other's sentences, but they do have a way of talking at the same time.
I mean, the only secrets would be behind the walls of the, in the homes. But,
yeah.
You know, to socialize.
And
we
things.
Used to have neighborhood parties.
You heard things.
The neighborhood was always invited. And we, I would say we partied a little more than I would like my kids
we,
to.
We, We heard things that would go around the park.
In Bear Brook Gardens, the Morgans were the center of gravity for the community. They threw the big barbecues, had all the neighborhood kids over for sleepovers.
We were all just friends.
Yeah.
And we helped each other. I can remember helping people cut wood.
Yeah. And Eddie, I mean,
on a hard winter, there were winters 10 below up there. Was nothing in the winter. And, you know, none of the cars in the neighborhood would start. Except for maybe one car would go. I remember going over to our friend's house, and that one car would start all our cars so we could all go to work. It's, you know, we were all just young families, so we didn't have money, you know.
The Morgans don't live in Allenstown anymore, but they remember it fondly. I think in their minds, they picture it like a postcard of country living. But that's not exactly how everyone remembers it.
So I was saying your name wrong. It's
Montpleasure.
Montpleasure.
Yeah, it can be pronounced different ways.
Is that French?
Ron Montpleasure was a police officer in Allenstown for 23 years.
It was, to describe it, it was on a Saturday afternoon, warm Saturday afternoon. People would start drinking about 10 o'clock in the morning.
Ron wears a beanie. He's got a big laugh that he covers with one hand. After retiring in 2002, he opened a cleaning supply shop about 20 minutes from Allenstown. We spoke standing behind the counter of that shop, surrounded by vacuum cleaner parts and bottles of cleaning spray. Montpleasure enjoys talking about his days on the force. He liked being a cop.
I think every kid in the neighborhood either wanted to be a police officer or a firefighter.
And he liked Allenstown, even if it wasn't a model community.
You talk about noise complaints, the country music was blaring. Not that I don't like country music. No, I do like country music. But as the alcohol flew, the music got louder and louder, and then the calls started to come in.
When the calls did come in, Montpleasure answered many of them on his own. Back then, there was usually only one officer on patrol in Allenstown at any given time. One cop for 20 square miles.
It's a lot of area of patrol, and there's only one patrolman on, and it's real, real hard to find, you know, to cover everything.
That was particularly true when it came to the state park. Bear Brook State Park. It covers more than half of Allenstown. The trailer park where Ann, Kevin, and Jesse Morgan lived hugs the northern edge of the state park. If you walked out the Morgan's back door in a straight line, it would be more than 5 miles before you saw another house. It's hard to capture just how dense and tangled the park is. There are some areas of Bear Brook that are easy to get to, a fly fishing pond, an archery station, a spiderweb of mountain biking trails. But most of the 15 square miles is thick and marshy. Aside from a couple of viewless hills, much of the park is flat, so you never have a good idea of where you are or where you've been. And it's wild, even for New Hampshire. Officer Montpleasure says his old police chief used to take him out into the park just for the fun of it.
He used to take me to catch rattlesnakes, timber rattlesnakes. And I never believed that there were rattlesnakes in New Hampshire. And sure enough, he goes, come on, we're going to go catch some rattlesnakes. Like, we are? And sure as heck, we come back with a couple of timber rattlers.
What he's trying to say is, this place is big.
It's huge. It's not someplace that you just drive cars into.
Officer Ron Montpleasure had been on the force in Allenstown for about 5 years, dealing mostly with drunk drivers, domestic disputes, and noise complaints. Small town cop stuff. Until 1985.
I was on duty. I was the officer that received the call.
Oh, so you were the first?
I was the first one on the scene.
The call was from a hunter. Montpleasure drove out to meet him at the edge of the woods.
And I met him, and he said, I think you need to go up on the hill and take a look in the barrel. He says, I think there's a body up there.
Montpleasure remembers that the hunter looked pale. He told him to stay behind with the squad car while he headed out into the woods alone.
I, knowing the area, knew that a lot of people would dispose of their pets back there. Thinking nothing of it, it's probably an animal. And it was hunting season. Somebody maybe had, you know, gotten a deer and brought the carcass out there.
He struck out through the woods. first along a path, then eventually bushwhacking a bit through the scrub.
The barrel was on the ground, and there was a bag. And when I opened the bag, well, the decomposed face was looking right at me.
It was November 1985, a few months after Jesse Morgan and his friends had kicked over the barrel. Now, Officer Montpleasure was looking at that same barrel. But unlike the kids, he knew what was really inside.
This is Word of Mouth. Today, we're presenting the first episode of NHPR's new true crime podcast, Bear Brook, hosted by Jason Moon. There's more coming up after a break.
Allenstown police officer Ron Montpleasure found himself alone in the woods, confronted by the face of the human remains he had just discovered. The weight of the situation began to press down on him.
This is major, you know. This isn't, you know, somebody parking in the fire lane. This is, you've got bodies, we have people.
Ron says his training from the police academy suddenly kicked in. He knew what to do.
I'm like, secure the area.
He began staking out the perimeter of a crime scene. But aside from the barrel, there wasn't much else to see. Trees. And how exactly do you stake out a perimeter in a forest this big? How far do you stretch the police tape? Montpleasure radioed for backup. He was the only patrolman on duty, so Allenstown officers must have been called in from their homes. And even then, cops turned to local residents for help.
I think I was still in bed, and we hear a knock on the door. I get up, and it was the police. He said, "Kevin, we need to deputize you to keep the press out." And he told me that they found bodies up at the pit.
As Kevin Morgan put on his boots to go help the police, his wife, Anne, was suddenly reminded of something their son, Jesse, had told her a few months earlier about a game of hide-and-seek and a barrel that they'd found in the woods.
It just came to me, you know, the smell, it came out like milk, he said.
How long was the barrel lying there? How many times had people walked right by, never realizing what was out there?
I just knew that was the one.
The barrel contained two bodies. One was a woman, the other a young girl. Investigators haven't released photos of the remains, so I haven't seen them. The details they have released, though, are grim. The remains were almost entirely skeletal. They were nude. They were dismembered, apparently to fit inside the barrel. And they were wrapped in plastic, tied together with electrical wire. Their skulls revealed that they were both killed by blows to the head with a blunt instrument. Based on the level of decomposition, investigators guessed the bodies had been in the barrel from anywhere from several months to a few years. Investigators often say that in a missing persons case, the first 48 hours are the most important. That's because if you don't find the person by then, your odds of ever finding them are really small. In a murder case, the first priority is to identify the victims. Most victims know their killers, but to know who the victim knew, you have to know who the victim is. And just like in a missing persons case, if investigators don't get this part figured out, their odds of success are really small. New Hampshire State Police took the lead in the Bear Brook investigation, and they immediately began by trying to ID the victims. Their working theory was that, given the ages, the victims were likely a mother and daughter. So they started searching for missing persons reports that matched. Meanwhile, the Allenstown PD started canvassing the town. Montpleasure says that's usually how crimes in Allenstown were solved. With all those neighborhood barbecues, not to mention all the drinking, gossip had a way of getting around. And he had his ways of getting it out of people.
We used to call it, let's go fishing. You know, you'd make a motor vehicle stop, and you knew somebody that may have known some information about a crime. My line was, you know any good fishing spots? And they knew what I was talking about. We weren't actually going fishing, but, you know, that meant the difference between, I mean, either receiving a warning or receiving a summons or just helping me out. And there was always somebody that knew a good fishing spot, always.
Whether it was a murder or a petty theft, this is how police work went in Allenstown in 1985. No high-tech forensics team, no criminal psychologist coming up with a suspect profile. Just a few patrol officers like Montpleasure, rattling the bushes, hoping something would fall out. Only nothing did.
And that was the first thing that threw me off, is like, this is strange, because everybody knew everything over there.
Meanwhile, the state police were having their own issues. They couldn't find any reports of a missing mother and daughter. Not in New Hampshire, not in neighboring states, not anywhere. Whoever these people were, it seemed that no one was looking for them. As the months started to roll by, police tried lots of ways to get any sort of foothold in the case. They checked the records of every elementary school in the state for some trace of the child victim. They examined 5 years of campground records at Bear Brook State Park. They sent out nationwide bulletins to law enforcement agencies with descriptions of the victims. They looked for matches to the adult victim in FBI databases of dental records. None of it worked. One corporal in the New Hampshire State Police called it the most frustrating case of his life. In 1986, several months after the barrel was discovered, composite sketches of the victims were made. The artists didn't have a lot to go on, just their hair and bone structure, so there was a lot of room for interpretation. But however inaccurate they may be, the sketches do manage to give the victims some measure of identity. Since no one knew what they looked like in life, seeing the drawings was kind of like seeing them for the first time. The adult victim looks tired. Her face is long, her cheeks a little gaunt. A shadow falls across her face. Detectives estimate she was in her mid to late 20s when she died. She was between 5'2" and 5'8". She had wavy, light brown hair. The girl is drawn in profile. She has a small, upturned nose. She wears a ponytail of dirty blonde hair with bangs swept across her forehead. Detectives think she was somewhere around 9 or 10 years old when she was murdered. When these sketches were released, calls started to come in. Investigators thought they might have something. But none of the tips panned out. Back in Allenstown, all anybody could do was speculate. Theories about the victims and who killed them were all over the place, ranging from organized crime to runaways and carnival workers. It seemed like everyone had a guess.
I can't see them not being local. You know, it could have been someone that lived up the street from me.
I always had it in my mind that it was a trucker living a double life.
I don't feel that they took them from the park, although they could have, because yeah. It abutted that area.
Pure speculation. I'm playing the Ouija board, but it's my gut feeling. You're going to find it, I would say, within a 200-250-mile radius of New Hampshire, I would say south. Southwest.
It's like irresistible for people to just start speculating. You just want to, like, know.
Right? You want to know.
As the months turned to years, investigators started to run out of ideas. To some, it seemed their best hope was to simply wait for the killer or someone who knew them to come forward on their own. In 1987, less than 2 years after the barrel was found, state police decided to release the victims' bodies so they could be buried. Officer Ron Montpleasure's chief, the one who'd shown him the rattlesnakes in the state park, organized the funeral. He told the local reporter at the time, quote, "Just because we don't know their names doesn't mean they don't deserve the same respect we do." Parishioners of St. John the Baptist Church in Allenstown pooled their money and paid for a gravesite at the church cemetery. A Catholic priest and a Methodist minister led a burial ceremony where the bodies were laid to rest in a single steel casket. Just a handful of town officials and reporters were there to see it.
And every time I used to patrol and go by that tombstone, you know, the wheels kept on turning. Just, was I on patrol that night when these bodies were dumped? And all the officers would think about that. When did this happen? How did I miss this? Or, you know, I mean, you start second-guessing yourself.
Burying the bodies seemed like the right thing to do, especially given that 2 years in, the case was going nowhere. But it also must have seemed like law enforcement had given up hope.
I was disappointed. All of a sudden now, the next thing I know, the town's getting together to put a headstone on these bodies. And what the hell? Who are these people?
For years, Jesse Morgan's parents kept the sketches of the victims pinned to their fridge. Like a lot of people in Allenstown, they'd always thought of their town as a good place. Now they struggled to reconcile that idea with what happened.
It was a whole different world for us. You know, it was like two worlds. Like, you know, there was this evil world going on that we had no idea about, and there was this good, wholesome world that was going on with the rest of the, you know, with the families and the children.
For Jesse Morgan, who as a kid stumbled across the bodies without really knowing it, the episode changed the woods of his childhood forever.
I do remember going out myself, like on rainy days or whatever, and walking around, like out there, out in the, where we never went, to see if I could find something. You know, like, is there more?
Turns out, there was. In the year 2000, John Cody was a detective in the state police's major crime unit. The unit handles most of the homicides in New Hampshire, and Cody had worked a long time to make it there. By that time, 15 years had passed since the barrel in Allenstown was discovered, and that mystery was just one on a long list of the state's unsolved cases. And the way those cases were handled back then was pretty informal.
Basically, what used to happen is when you got assigned to the major crime unit, you would get assigned one or two, or sometimes three, cold cases. And when I picked up the Allenstown case, I didn't know anything about this case.
Cody was expected to work on the case basically in his free time, whenever he wasn't working an active case. But Cody says the details of the Bear Brook murders just kept gnawing at him.
It's the type of case where you start reading it, you know, it's sort of like getting into an engrossing book. You start to read the first chapter and you just want to go on to the second, which makes you to go on to the third, etc.
Cody decided to get a look at the evidence in person. He went to the evidence storage area where he saw the blue barrel, the plastic, the electrical wire, clues that had been sitting idle for 15 years.
I'm a very visual person, so I decided one day, it was actually a Friday, and I said, I'm going to go see where this area is, try to get an idea of what it is, what I'm looking at through words.
Cody drove out to Allenstown and walked into the woods. He brought the case file with him as a sort of map. First, he tried to find the area where Jesse Morgan and his friends had first found the barrel as kids. He pictured the kids on the four-wheeler, the barrel in the brush.
I was walking through that. I had been out there for quite a while. And then I kind of just widened my area a little bit, almost like throwing a rock into a pond. You have those concentric rings that come out.
Cody ventured further and further from the spot where the barrel was found, his eyes scanning the forest floor for anything that didn't belong. It was getting late in the afternoon. The sun was sinking behind the hills. The canopy of trees overhead in Bear Brook State Park made it even darker. Cody was thinking about how he might need to go back out to his car for his flashlight.
And that's when I came across the barrel.
A barrel was on its side next to a small boulder and some brush. Cody recognized it right away. He'd been looking at a barrel just like it in evidence storage a few days before. Dark blue, 55 gallons. Cody decided now was a good time to get the flashlight after all. He made his way back out to the edge of the woods, his mind racing the whole time.
You know, I think I was trying to talk myself out of it the whole way to the car, going, this is definitely not what I think it is.
When Cody returned with his flashlight, he shined it inside the barrel, and all he could see was some kind of plastic.
And I tore the plastic away, and there was something white that was shining towards me. You know, kind of sticks out with the dark background. When I looked at it, I said, this does not look good.
It was a stunning discovery, one that raised a whole new set of questions, some of them uncomfortable for police. John Cody was standing just 300 feet from where the first barrel was found a full 15 years before. Inside the second barrel were two more bodies. Coming up on Bear Brook.
When you hear the phrase, a stone's throw away, this is what they're talking about.
Why wasn't that barrel found?
We don't know.
Okay, you know, I don't, you know, to me, that's
crazy.
I want to thank everyone again for coming today. We have some new testing results that we want to share with basically the world.
I opened the door and saw his face. I had a chill run down my back that I've never in my life ever had before.
Sometimes it's that dumb luck that you just come across something and it just opens a door for you. And once you open the door, it's like, oh, you know what I mean? The lights come on and you could see everything. The jigsaw puzzle comes together.
That was Jason Moon, host of Bear Brook, a new podcast from NHPR. It's now available on iTunes. Jason is in the studio with us, so stick around. We're going to talk about how this podcast project came to be after a break. Welcome back to Word of Mouth. Your questions answered.
Your state explored.
I am Taylor Quimby.
I'm Jackie Helbert.
And we're in the studio with Jason Moon, a reporter here at NHPR and the host of the new podcast, Bear Brook. So we just listened to the first episode. Jason, you mentioned towards the beginning a little bit, you talk about this, but how did you wind up covering this story? It's not really in your job description.
No, not exactly. And in a kind of the least interesting way for a reporter to find a story, a press conference. So we got a press release from the Attorney General's office that there was new information about a cold case. And I was just kind of the person standing in the newsroom at the right or wrong time, depending on how you look at it. And I got assigned to go cover the press conference. And that was my first initiation into the case. I didn't know anything about it. And then from there, I never stopped.
Yeah. Were you super confused when you first got into it?
Confused, but riveted more, I think, is the better word. I mean, just the bare facts of the case are pretty enthralling. I mean, here you have basically a family murdered and discarded in the woods, and no one knows who they are. And just how does that happen?
Yeah.
Didn't anyone notice that they had gone missing? And then on top of that, there was this new scientific technique that they were using on the remains that also really interested me and you know, is the basis for some of the later episodes in the podcast.
Yeah, I was going to give a little warning here because we're likely in this conversation to spoil some of the stuff coming up later, although it is all information that people could find on the internet should they want to. But I guess knowing that we're going to talk about some of these things, what about this case makes it really stand out from a historic perspective?
Well, it really pushed the boundaries of forensic science in some important ways. Perhaps the easiest way to explain it is that if people have remember from earlier this year the news of the Golden State Killer arrest from out in California, that case, that arrest was made possible because of a new forensic technique that relies on genetic genealogy.
Well, cutting-edge science may have solved a decades-long cold case. The so-called Golden State Killer wanted for
this morning, a wave of new charges piling up against Joseph DeAngelo, the suspected serial killer accused of terrorizing California in the 70s and 80s.
And the detectives working the Golden State Killer case were actually inspired by the use of that technique in the Bear Brook case. And so it was a proof of concept for criminal investigations that this could be used, that it could help solve cases that have been unsolved for decades, you know, some seemingly unsolvable until this technique comes around. And so it really kicked off what some people are calling a new era of criminal investigations where you can use this genetic information people have uploaded online to catch criminals.
It's kind of crazy because, you know, we just listened to the first episode and what you hear is that investigators have basically nothing. And it's almost like the very fact that there was so little information is what necessitates new technology. And so all the stuff that you're talking about, this genetic genealogy, the reason that it became a tool is because there was just none of the usual stuff that you need to solve a murder case.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, what's the phrase? Invention is the mother of necessity, or is it the other way around?
Yeah, it's one of those.
My mother is invention, and she's necessary. yeah, it's true. Police really, I mean, that's why you turn to forensics in general in a police investigation, is because you don't have witnesses, you don't have the sort of, you know, the low-hanging fruit just isn't there.
Mm.
So looking back on a case that started 30 years ago, how do you proceed? Like, I'm sure there's so much information. Where do you start?
Yeah, well, good question. For me, I just started back at the location where the bodies were found. So I went back to folks who lived in Allenstown, New Hampshire, the Morgans, you heard from in episode one, who, you know, remember that time, the officer who found it. You know, I tried to focus on people who had firsthand experiences with the case, whether that was they were there at the beginning or they, you know, devoted a significant amount of time working on it, like some other folks that we'll meet later in the series. And I mean, that, you know, that's one of the things that's interesting to me about the case, as well as is how it's affected other people. I mean, you heard from Jesse Morgan, who found the first barrel as a kid, didn't really know it, but found out later, and how that kind of changed. You know, that's a huge moment in his childhood forever, right? That changes his own idea of his childhood and what it meant to grow up in Allenstown, New Hampshire. For his parents, it changed how they thought about their community. For some police officers, it sort of haunted them. It was this albatross hanging around their neck. You know, there's a lot of personal drama and all that was really interesting to me, as well as everything else I've mentioned that also kept me wanting to hear more about the story.
You're saying that a lot of true crime podcasts like sensationalize murder and that kind of thing's off-putting. With the explosion, the huge amount of true crime podcasts out there, how did you go about trying to make Bear Brook unique, put it in your own voice?
That's a good question. And, I to be honest, I'm not yet totally sure that I have, that we have accomplished that. You know, I think that's ultimately for others to judge. But it was something that was always on my mind putting the series together, you know, particularly in talking about the victims in the case. It's really difficult in this case because obviously we don't know the victims. We don't know anyone who knew them. We don't know almost anything about them. So you have to try to find other ways to, you know, just remind the listener that these were real people that really were murdered and left in the woods in New Hampshire. And you know, it's a balancing act between, you know, keeping that emotional truth grounding you, but meanwhile, you know, being able to go out and talk about the fascinating science about trying to solve their murders. You know, you don't want to lose sight of any of it. So you're trying to have to balance all of it and keep it all corralled together. You know, I hope we have done that, and I hope we haven't sensationalized it. But like I said, I guess that's up to our listeners to make that determination.
Well, as someone who's listened to it, I I really think you achieved that. I don't think it's sensational.
Thank you.
And it doesn't sound like everything else out there. So.
Thank you.
It is weird, though. You know, there was an article I was reading recently, and it was about the true crime genre, which by the sort of very formula that it puts out there, tends to objectify women as victims. So, you know, usually the setup is a woman is murdered, and now we're going to sort of investigate, you know, through detective work and mystery to find out who did that. And so the very role that the murdered victim often plays is, like, pretty superficial. You get a few details, and then it's just about the motive. And this case does seem so much more complicated in that you don't even have the surface details of your victims to bring out there. You know, a body that hasn't been identified is almost by definition an object. We call it a body. Hmm. Although in this case, you know, potentially you could have started with the killer, who we don't hear anything about for a few episodes.
Yeah.
And just like, it kind of reminds me, just a side note, of the movie Signs or whatever, where you know the monster's there, but you don't know what it is or whatever. It's kind of like that. You're like, what the heck happened? Hmm.
I don't know. Do you? How do you feel being compared to a Shyamalan?
Wasn't that like right before he like?
Yeah, that was a peak, good right? one. It's yeah. not the mermaid one.
Yeah.
It was before The Last Airbender, which is the saddest, most terrible movie of all time. So one of the things that was really fun to work on this project with you, but also to sort of hear what you did, is that you got to work on a lot of the music. So how did your process go for that?
Yeah, it was really by necessity in mixing the first episodes, the first drafts of some of the first episodes, you know, searching for music that I wanted to not sensationalize the story, not overdo it, but, you know, create some emotion for listeners. I found it was just so time consuming to click through, you know, I spent whole days, literally whole days clicking through, you know, MP3s, like listening to 5 seconds of a piece of music and saying like, no, I don't think that's right. So there was a moment, a point I reached where I just decided like, this will just be faster if I just like hammer out, you know, what I considered to be drafts, kind of placeholder moods, music to do it. And that turned out to work. And I went back a few other times a little more intentionally and tried to write out some other things, you know, creating a theme for the series, which is, you know, always nice to have some continuity, consistency. Yeah, I'm just happy it worked out. I feel lucky that it worked out in that way.
Was it weird for you? I mean, you don't usually get to use music in your reporting because, you know, the standard stuff that you're going to hear on NHPR, it's a lot of news where you still have a lot of storytelling craft, but music isn't usually a piece of it. And the spacing, you know, a big part of a project like this is kind of giving something time, something, you know, just like literally inserting 5 seconds of silence to let a powerful moment breathe. So what was that like, you know, going from the old, you know, the newsroom reporting style into podcasting?
Well, it was, you know, I mean, it was an incredible learning experience. I feel like I have, you know, picked up some tricks and tips that I can hopefully take back with me to the newsroom and, you know, can make my news features a little more, you know, full, lush. And it was also a challenge in that, you know, I think, you know better than anyone, Taylor, you know, editing the stories, how sometimes I needed to be pushed a little bit to share more about my own experience reporting on it, you know, which is something that you really don't do in a news story, you know, talking in the first person
yeah.
that often, or describing how I felt at a certain point in the story, things like that, which, you know, clearly make for a better, more rich, more full story when you have this time and space to do it. But becoming comfortable doing that, learning how to do that, it was just like learning how to score a piece and put music in it. I feel very fortunate to have been able to work on this project for, you know, my own future as a storyteller. And so, yeah, I'm just lucky.
So what do you plan on working on next?
You mean after this podcast is finished?
Mm-hmm.
So after the podcast, I'll be back to, you know, being a sort of normal reporter in the newsroom. I'll be covering health, but it'll be interesting, sort of kicking off the dust on one hand, and also trying to bring some new stuff to my old job on the other hand, and we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, and I expect that this is not the last time you'll be asked to maybe talk about Bear Brook.
I also suspect that.
Yeah, some mysteries left unanswered that may yet someday still come to light.
I sense an update episode.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Jason Moon, NHPR reporter and host of the new podcast, Bear Brook. You can subscribe wherever you get podcasts or find out more at bearbrookpodcast.org. That's it for Word of Mouth today. The staff includes Jimmy Gutierrez, Hannah McCarthy, Justine Paradise, Ben Henry, and Jackie Helbert. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is director of Wishing Headphones Came With a Warranty.
Bear Brook is reported and produced by Jason Moon. Taylor Quimby is senior producer. Original music by Jason Moon and Taylor Quimby. Additional music in this episode is from Jazar, Blue Dot Sessions, and Simple Minds.
Word of Mouth and Bear Brook are productions of New Hampshire Public Radio.